case number 56773, G.C. Wallace versus the 8th Judicial District Court, and the real party in interest, Reef Centra Point B2348 Incorporated. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
May it please the court, I'm Todd Tootin, appearing for G.C. Wallace. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time, if I may, on reply. In this case, a commercial landlord sued twice. In both claims, they brought their action based upon the same lease, relied upon the same breach of payment of rent, and in the first action, there was a final judgment.
They sought eviction in one, and they sought damages in the second. Is that a fair statement?
That's right. Okay. And the first action bars the second by operation of Nevada's claim preclusion doctrine. The trial court determined that even though the statute at BNRS 40.253 says you're to bring your action in whichever court has jurisdiction, jurisdiction which is defined by the amount of the damage sought as part of the claim.
And could that amount have been determined at the time that the summary eviction was sought, and wouldn't it have necessarily, just by virtue of the monthly rent amount, have been in excess of the jurisdiction of the Justice Court?
First question, yes. It can be determined because in this case, the general rule is if you elect to evict, you are not at liberty to sue for future rents. In fact, that's a restatement established principle, unless the lease reserves the right to pursue claims for future rent for you. And in this case, you'll see we've argued that the lease, paragraph 11B, said, you know, you can sue as rent becomes due if you don't evict the tenant, if you preserve the right of possession. If you do evict, then you look to paragraph 8A sub 3, and there the lease said you bring your claim for rent, it's an acceleration. So at the point in time where they elected to do an eviction, they've accelerated the rent claim, it all became due and payable, and the claim was fully matured. In other words, the powder is not dry here to pursue future rent.
So it exceeded the jurisdictional amount, I think we would all agree, it exceeded the jurisdictional amount of the Justice Court because the monthly rent was, I think, $81,000 and change by the time you added everything onto it. So in other words, your argument is that it should have been brought, instead of in the Justice Court, it should have been brought in the first instance in the District Court.
Well, not at all. Frequently, landlords will use the Justice Court because they're not pursuing a claim for damages, or they have their specific concern is, in this case, they've argued the convenience of the Justice Court. But once you've invoked a court with jurisdiction, and claim preclusion is all about jurisdiction, you have, in fact, engaged the claim preclusion principles. You have kind of the chart in the air here. You have the transaction or occurrence. Here, the same lease, same breach, same rent. You have causes of action that arise from that transaction or occurrence. And within the causes of action, maybe more than one from a transaction, which themselves have remedies. And in this case, we've talked about the wrongful detainer remedy. Summary eviction is identified in the statute as a supplemental remedy, and wrongful detention under the statutes 40.300 and 40.360 identify specifically how you prepare your complaint for wrongful detention and what kind of judgment you get, and both of those specifically say you recover your rent in a wrongful detention action as part of the remedy. Now, what Judge Earle did when he said whichever means you can actually sue in both was reasoned, that's the error that we believe that he made, but he reasoned there by saying had they coupled this summary eviction claim with a claim for damage, as they're entitled to in Justice Court, then he wouldn't, he would see things our way and find that there was claim preclusion.
But they had purposely not done so based upon the jurisdictional limitations.
Well, I don't think it's based upon the jurisdictional limitations. It's once you have a transaction or occurrence, you go down the cause of action. In this case, the remedies are available, the action for rent, the summary eviction, maybe a writ of restitution if there's a non-monetary breach. You take your shopping cart, and if you put one of those remedies in the cart and then check out, claim preclusion attaches at the point in time where the judgment is final.
Well, you're forgetting the third element of Five Star that talks about whether or not the action could
exactly.
have
been. And that is really the insight into where Judge Earle erred. His analysis is based upon a connection or a nexus between remedies. He's saying, had you only put another remedy in the basket, you would have claim preclusion. There's no authority for an exception to the doctrine of claim preclusion based upon a selection of remedies. And, of course, we go back, and claim preclusion is really jurisdictional, and it's based upon the transaction or occurrence. It might include multiple causes of action, and those causes of action will all have remedies.
But wasn't summary eviction devised as a means to get an errant or a defaulting tenant quickly out of a property and then allow the landlord to pursue damages once that eviction had taken place?
Sure, and you can do that in either justice court or district court, and you have been able to since 1989 when the statute was amended. In 91, they amended again to straighten out the notice provision so they weren't directing people only to justice court.
But the process in district court is far more cumbersome, and it delays that process.
That is their argument. But this court's recently had a decision, the Berkson case, talking about separation of powers. The legislature determines the jurisdiction, and this case, claim preclusion, involves jurisdiction. With respect to convenience of the parties and the efficiency of the court system, that is for rulemaking at the court level to provide efficiencies and organize the dockets of the court. And I'm not sure I agree that it's just absolutely more efficient than justice court, but that issue really has nothing to do with the outcome of the case.
Certainly is quicker in terms of getting your tenant out of the property and even minimizing your damages or mitigating damages, wouldn't you agree?
Well, there's no reason that it should be. District court could have the same rules that justice court has to administer summary evictions. The point is that claim preclusion is jurisdictional. The actual convenience of court rules and the expedited process is for the convenience of the parties. I'd like to go a little...
Mr. Tuden, before you move on to a different subject, I have a question for you. You argue that the basis for barring this claim is claim preclusion, and but there are at least a couple of cases, the Second Circuit, for example, Tennessee appellate court also has held that claim preclusion does not exist where the court in which the initial action was filed lacked the authority to give the full relief that is sought in the second action. What is your position with regard to those authorities?
It's exactly the rule of the restatement that we're directing the court's attention to, restatement of judgments, Section 25, of limited jurisdiction, meaning 10,000 or less, has no effect on the preclusive nature of claim preclusion. You know, there's many possibilities here, if that were not the case, of trying to use the jurisdiction of the court as a strategy. This is a situation where there was a damage claim available. The fact that the court had limited jurisdiction has no bearing at all on the effect of claim preclusion. And in terms of convenience, there are forms of action. This was brought up in the briefs there. Rule 2 of the Justice Court Rules talks in terms of three forms of action. Forms of action are matters of convenience, dealing with procedure, and nothing more. Rule 82 actually says they have nothing to do with the jurisdiction or the venue of the court. And if it were not the case, then if that were not true, then of course that rule would actually violate Nevada's constitution, which says there's only one form of action in Nevada, Article 6, and it's a civil action. So what we're saying is it's clear that, you know, the forms of action have no bearing on the scope and extent of the jurisdiction of the court. And once you enter the court with jurisdiction to give the relief that you now contend in the second case, you're entitled to, claim preclusion has attached, and prejudice, if you will, attaches when you've come to a court with jurisdiction. And clearly that's what happened. We have also seen arguments that, well, the summary eviction itself doesn't permit the recovery of damages. Well, the cause isn't summary eviction. That's a supplemental remedy. The cause is unlawful detainer. And unlawful detainer, again, under the statute, permits you to claim for recovery of rent. So it clearly is available. And under Five Star, those things that are available are precluded. The there are some cases cited wherein the invitation from our opponent is, please write an exception to the doctrine of claim preclusion in this case. And they're referring you to cases from Michigan, New York, Florida that all had vastly different statutes. The Bella case from California had a different statute, a three-day notice situation where the property had been sold, the tenant held over. Different, but I would like to point out that even under Bella, which spoke to the test with respect to res judicata of directly connected, nothing could be more directly connected to the summary eviction than the same lease, the same rent, breach of that lease. So even if you looked at Bella, you would find that claim preclusion still applied, and Bella is a terrible case in terms of its outcome. I reserve the rest of my time unless there are questions. Thank you.
Mr. Larson.
May it please the court, Bart Larson of the law firm of Colas R. Latham on behalf of Real Party and Interest, Reef Center Point, B2348. Regardless of the thoroughness of G.C. Wallace's brief in this case, the skill of its counsel, there is one inescapable fact that they just can't outrun that undermines the entire argument. And that is the fact that the summary eviction statute and the 1991 amendments to that statute on which they rely so heavily were clearly intended to benefit landlords, provide a quick and inexpensive means of removing a non-paying tenant from the property. And G.C. Wallace's interpretation of that statute now turns that legislative intent 180 degrees to provide a giant pitfall into which a landlord might fall, lose all claims for damages against a tenant by simply following the statute and obtaining a summary eviction in justice court, which the statute provides for, without making a claim for damages.
Could you go into district court on the claim?
Not without bundling it together with a claim for damages in excess of $10,000.
Sure. But you still could have reached the same place, as the appellant argues, by starting in the district court.
Ultimately, yes. It would not have been as quick or as easy.
Certainly.
And it's a bit of a misnomer to state that it was the landlord that commenced the justice court action for summary eviction. True, the landlord's property manager did serve a five-day notice, which directed the tenant to respond by filing an affidavit in justice court. But it was the tenant that commenced the case by filing that affidavit in justice court, and that's clearly what Justice Court Rule Civil Procedure 102 provides. So it was not the landlord that actually commenced the first action tenant. In terms of the elements of res judicata, of course, we know we must have the same parties, a valid judgment, and the second action must be based on the same claim as the first. And in that case, that's where res judicata argument falls short in this case. Summary eviction action is an action relating only to possession of real property. It's not an action for damages. Neither NRS 40.253 or the Justice Court Rules of Civil Procedure relating to summary evictions provide for any award of damages in connection with an order of summary granting.
But under the third element of Five Star, you could have brought a claim for damages.
Based on unlawful detainer, we could have. We did not do that, and we have not done that. The district court action is not a claim for damages based on unlawful detainer. It's a claim for damages based on breach of a contract. And that's what separates the two. That's why it's not the same claim as in the first. And to give an example.
But you could have brought the claim for damages in the summary eviction proceeding in the justice court.
In this case, no. The amount of damages would have exceeded the $10,000 jurisdictional limit.
That has to do with the amount. You might have been capped at your recovery of $10,000. But you could have brought a claim for damages in the justice court.
It could have. They would have had to have filed a complaint for damages or a small claims complaint under the rules. As Mr. Toon pointed out, justice court rules of civil procedure do specify three different types of actions in justice court, you know, a civil action, a small claims action, and a summary eviction action. I don't think there's any argument that the initial proceedings in this matter involved only a summary eviction argument. There was never any claim for damages made, although, as you pointed out, it could have been.
So under Five Star, the third element was available to you and arguably has been satisfied.
The availability of a claim doesn't necessarily preclude it in a subsequent action. It's whether or not the claim is the same as the claim that was brought in the first case. That's the third element of Five Star. The simple fact that it was available is not dispositive of the issue. And you can look at the Reno Star case as an example of that, where
Five Star goes a little bit further than same claims. It also says same claims or any part of them.
True, it does. But again, it's a distinction between a claim for damages flowing from unlawful detainer versus a claim for damages flowing from the breach of a contract. Admittedly, we couldn't turn around and sue for unlawful detainer damages in a subsequent case after obtaining summary eviction. I don't dispute that. But the breach of contract damages is what's being claimed in the district court case. And to give an example that might clarify this, if we're dealing with a month-to-month tenancy where there is no lease at issue, no damages to be claimed for breaching that lease, a tenant fails to pay rent, a landlord obtains a summary eviction, and after retaking possession of the property, discovers all kinds of damage to the property.
Well, on this same issue that we've been discussing, the Second Circuit and Tennessee Appellate Court have held that a claim preclusion does not apply where the initial forum did not have the power to award the full measure of relief, which is your argument, and as a consequence, is sought in the later litigation, and as a consequence, the third element of Five Star could not have been satisfied. Counsel's rebuttal a moment ago to that position was that the restatement section 25 rejects that notion. Why shouldn't this court follow the restatement as he characterizes it?
I don't know that the restatement actually rejects that notion. I think we're talking apples and oranges here. In the situation where the court doesn't have the authority to provide the damages that are being sought in a subsequent action, it doesn't come down simply to the amount of the damages, as counsel suggested. We have a situation here where a summary eviction action was brought. The court has no authority to award any damages whatsoever in connection with the summary eviction action. Granted, that summary eviction action could have been coupled with a civil action or small claims action, some other claim for damages, but it was not. So the Justice Court never had any authority to enter any award whatsoever in any amount for damages.
Well, they had the authority, you just didn't ask for it.
It was never an issue, correct.
Well, but the Second Circuit and the Tennessee Appellate Court say that even though you could have sought damages, there's no way the limited jurisdiction court could have given you the full measure of your relief. Mm-hmm. Counsel's argument is that the restatement says it doesn't matter whether you would have gotten the full measure of relief. The court is, this panel is faced with making a choice between that precedent I've referred to and the restatement section 25 that counsel has referred to, and I'm asking you to argue which of the two and why should we pick one over the other.
If it comes down to a choice between the two, I think the court needs to look at the public policy supporting the adjudication of disputes on their merits. Rather, pitfalls into which an unwary litigant might accidentally step, not intending to forfeit its claim for damages or waive any claim for damages down the road. But another element that's instructive in this case is the actual language of Section 40.253. Section 6 in particular specifies, you know, what happens after there's been a hearing on an order for eviction. Specifically state, if the landlord prevails, summary eviction is ordered. That order has no preclusive effect on the subsequent ability of the tenant to claim damages or any other relief in a subsequent action. It also states that if summary eviction is denied, it has no preclusive effect on the landlord's ability to seek to bring an unlawful detainer action subsequently. There are clear cues in the statute. The legislature never intended a summary eviction statute to have a preclusive effect on a subsequent claim. I don't think there's any ambiguity as to that point.
Does this result in claim splitting?
It does not, no. They're two separate claims, a claim based in contract and a claim based in unlawful detainer of real property. And the Reno Club case, I think, is illustrative of the distinction, because you have a situation there where a party brought an unlawful attainder case against another party seeking to remove them from a property they claim leasehold rights in. They prevailed on that action and then subsequently filed a separate action for damages flowing from that unlawful detainer. And this court held that, no, you can't do that. You can't seek unlawful detainer damages in a subsequent case when there's already been an unlawful detainer case brought and a final judgment entered. But as to personal property, which was also claimed in that case, that was never addressed in the prior action. The court held that the claim for damages flowing from the unjust refusal to surrender that personal property was not precluded by res judicata. And it's a situation where they're separate claims, just as they are in this case. We have a claim for breach of contract versus a claim for unlawful detainer in the earlier action. And the distinct nature of those two claims is what prevents res judicata from applying in this case. And in terms of, to take sort of a big picture view of the case, as Judge Earle recognized, summary eviction in justice court is a much faster, much less expensive remedy than pursuing an unlawful detainer or even summary eviction in district court. Landlords, even commercial landlords, often handle these matters themselves to save on money. The result of the interpretation that G.C. Wallace has advanced in this case will impact hundreds, if not thousands, of commercial landlords here in Nevada who have processed untold numbers of evictions over the last few years as the economy has faltered. It would unjustly deny those landlords any claim to relief they might have for breach of contract damages or other damages associated with a tenancy that was terminated through a summary eviction in justice court. And the result simply isn't just. It's not what the legislature intended. In fact, it runs completely contrary to the legislature's intent in enacting the summary eviction statute and in amending it to facilitate these evictions, prevent tenants from raising frivolous arguments as to jurisdiction and other matters that will delay eviction and thwart landlords' attempts to exercise their rights in their own property. And unless the court has other questions, I will leave it at that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chutin. Counsel tried to draw a distinction between a right to possession of the property versus damages, and I think the Reno Club case tells you there is no such distinction. This was a deprivation of property. First judgment was entered. They sued for damages in the second case, arising only after the first judgment. And the court said those claims are barred. With respect to the wisdom of choosing between the two paths before the court, we have a justice court that has jurisdiction over claims made for $10,000 or less. To adopt some different rule than the restatement means people would sue, get a $10,000 justice court, then turn around and sue for the rest of their damage again against the same party in district court. And with respect to that, there's sort of a judicial head fake going on for the parties in the justice court who think they're only trying the case in justice court and not trying a separate and serial action later on. And of course, prejudice is exactly that when you're sued twice, and that's what claim preclusion protects litigants from. The rule in Nevada is clear, and the five-star principles can be applied here to the clear language of the statute. That's what we've asked for. When one thinks about it, claim preclusion is literally the bedrock principle of judicial administration, the administration of justice. Everyone here in the room should be able to understand a very clear rule so we know when things are over. And if you rise to the invitation to draft an exception to the rule of claim preclusion for this case, it's a great disservice and creates a potential uncertainty. I've heard the public policy argument the council made about what happens to landlords, and I think it's exactly the opposite. The landlords have available to them two different courts. They get all of their claims in one place. That's what the legislature intended. to say that, no, we should allow two different actions when the statute now says whichever court has jurisdiction, it just seems to me to go directly against the clear language of the statute.
Mr. Chairman, I'm a little confused because you keep suggesting that the respondent in this case is asking us to write an exception around Five Star. I guess I don't see it that way. What I'm hearing them say is that Five Star, just simpler, the claim preclusion doctrine just doesn't apply here because we wanted the tenant out, proceeding number one. We're now proceeding in proceeding number two for our damages. I don't see that as an exception. I see that as a distinction that would cause at least my analysis to go through the Five Star 3 points and find one applies, two applies, number three does not.
Well, with respect, the transaction or occurrence is the lease. All the remedies, whether it's possession or damage, exist in the same cause of action. That's the error the trial court made, was saying this depends upon the relationship between the remedies here. It doesn't. It depends upon what is encompassed within a cause of action and a transaction or occurrence, because there may be multiple causes of action. That's the way res judicata claim preclusion functions, in those parameters, not an analysis of whether or not you raised one remedy as a component of a claim. And that gets back to something counsel just said. He said we had a claim for summary eviction. Actually, summary eviction says it's a supplemental remedy. The claim is unlawful detainer. No other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tootin. Thank you, Mr. Larson. Thank you for your parties here today. This case will stand submitted. We'll be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.